Hi, this is Alan Gleeson, and you're listening to The Sassholes with Jamie, Jason, and Pete.
Welcome to Sassholes, a show dedicated to issues within the software as a service industry. We are revenue ops with a
edge.
Not bad. Jamie, KG, and myself, Pete, have a combined 100 years of making interesting decisions. Please subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Today, our guest is Alan Gleeson. Alan Gleeson is a B2B SaaS marketing consultant with a particular interest in scaling B2B SaaS startups by helping them to generate more leads and to grow their businesses. Alan started his career in financial services in the UK at Barclays, a leading financial services company. He then went on to work as chief marketing officer for a number of VC-backed SaaS companies. For the past 8 years, he's been working with fast-growing B2B SaaS startups as a strategic marketing consultant with his London-based company, Work With Agility. But before we get to Alan, this episode is brought to you by NeuroNoodle. Hey, parents of athletes, get a doodle of their noodle, which is a brain map, before the season starts so you have a baseline to compare to. You get a physical every year, right? Schedule a brain checkup now at neuronoodle.com. Takes only 20 minutes to get the data you need to ensure the quality of your athlete's future life. KG?
You're going to pick on me today. Jamie's not here. Yes, Pete, what do you got?
My friend was showing me his tool shed. He pointed to the ladder. He said, that's my step ladder. He said, I never knew my real ladder. leave us some comments on our blog at sassholes.net. Thank you for the glorious laughter there, KG. You're almost as good as our old buddy Jason. You got any shout outs, KG?
I do. You know what you need to do, yeah, Pete? You need to, like, you know, get the Brady Bunch canned laughter in there next time. But you get me every time with those, though, though I'm reading them.
Yes.
In the show notes. They're good. I got some shout outs here. So congratulations to Rachel Essenfeld for being promoted to Senior Manager of Partnerships and Growth at JobGet. We used to work together at ZipRecruiter. Congratulations, Rachel. Congratulations to Aaron Johnson for starting a new position as Sales Manager at Restaurant 365 with my friend and former guest on the show, Will Emmons. Remember when we had Will Emmons on the show, Pete?
Oh, absolutely. Good old Will.
That's right. And then a happy birthday to Liza Dunham, formerly of ZipRecruiter. She's a badass operations person. And congratulations to Lindsay Taylor, formerly of ZipRecruiter as well, for starting a new position as Senior Manager, Global Systems Operations at Uberall. And that's all she wrote.
My shout outs are Steve Vicentino got a new job as Vice President of Sales at iHeartMedia. Steve, I heart you, buddy. Ben Shute for being promoted to Sales Director, staffing at ePace Systems, and old school Eric Lochner starting a new position as Chief Executive Officer at MeetingPlay and Aventury. Long time no see, Eric. Hope you're doing well. Okay, casual conversation. Are we ready, guys?
Let's do it.
Certainly are. Let's go.
Alan, please tell us about yourself. How'd you get to where you are today, my friend, across the pond in the UK?
That's it. I guess when you were leaving university, potentially a bit like myself, there was no such thing as B2B SaaS, right? And no such thing as digital marketing. So I guess that's something that's useful for all people starting off in their careers. The world is changing quite a lot, right? I started in finance. I'm from Cork in Ireland originally. I graduated with economics and marketing as a primary degree. Then I did an MSc in strategy, so strategy marketing. Joined Barclays, a UK financial services company, on their grad program. This is going back in time. I'll fast track a little bit. I worked in a strategic division there, and we were looking at this fancy new thing coming out called the internet. I ended up working in internet strategy for Barclays. I ended up leaving after a couple of years and then joined an American software company. And believe it or not, we were shipping boxes of software. So again, wow. I don't know if you guys can remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was selling software in a box that was in a retail store. We're trying to get eye-level positions. We're trying to get people picking it up in the store, loading it onto their CPU-based computers, running it off the desktop, all that good stuff. And we all noticed that 56K dial-ups were speeding up. Internet was getting quicker and transitioned as a result of that into SaaS. So I've been in, working in SaaS ever since, and more recently as a consultant at the sort of strategic level, helping a mix of venture capital backed B2B SaaS startups.
Pushing those floppy disks, huh?
Can you remember them?
Were there 5 1/4, 3 1/2, or both?
We were the round disks. We were the round disks, right?
Sorry.
Wow, those are the days. Well, you know, we take it for granted, you know, we talk about SaaS on the show and the SaaS holes, et cetera. But tell us, Alan, you know, what is B2B SaaS, software as a service, and why are you, you know, why did you gravitate towards it? Why are you interested in it?
Great question. So SaaS, you know, is software as a service, right? So it's software, not hardware. And of course, there's consumer applications and there's business applications. I guess the early days of SaaS was very much in the business sort of sphere, and sort of that's the area I'm in my career. I find it endlessly fascinating, right? So we kind of alluded to it there. You know, it's still, you know, a very, very new sort of industry, right? Because, you know, wearing a European hat for a second, you know, we were probably slower to get fast connections in the US. We were probably slower to get startups out there. There hasn't been that cycle to the same extent where you've had lots of people go through the journey of starting a business and scaling up and exiting, right? And then creating the next wave. So it's still a very kind of early stage, which means that I guess there's lots of opportunity. It's also very nuanced, right? I find it intellectually very challenging because we all love playbooks, right? But the crazy thing is it's very hard to have playbooks for SaaS, right? Because, you know, SaaS can cover everything from a $20 a month, you know, application to something that's, you know, 500K and plus a year, right? So within that, there's a whole mix of different things. So there's some of the reasons that I find it so fascinating. I don't know, do you guys share those sort of feelings or you know, from your knowledge of what appeals to you guys?
Well, we're old enough to remember, you know, EDS, Electronic Data Systems, right? You know, Ross Perot's company. And so, you know, right, if you really go back in the day, software as a service is not really like, it's not new per se, but it's far more prevalent now. And honestly, Alan, I can't even imagine a scenario where somebody ships me a disk and it's, you know, down. In fact, I downloaded something for Adobe on my computer yesterday. And I thought, my God, it's weird. It's not in the cloud. It's not it was weird that it wasn't, you know? And I'm sure as everything, you know, shifts, but you're right. You know, Pete and I are dyed in the wool sales guys and, you know, we've sold large packages, software as a service, as well as highly transactional, $400 a month, you know, type of,
right,
you know, try. And there is nuances. And of course, some of the larger packages, Alan, as you know, there's an onboarding process, you know, that takes a long time and getting data over, whereas, you know, the $20 a month thing, it's not. So those nuances definitely make it, you know, unique and challenging in and of itself. Right, Pete?
Yeah, I think SaaS, I'm trying to think what the year was. I mean, everybody was trying to copy telecom where you could get that good subscription revenue in, where you didn't just sell, you know, transactional, then you can get the ARR. You want to take a stab? What year did Microsoft start that? I don't even remember, because they did their Office per month. And
I mean, there's a couple of ways of looking at it, right? So in the UK, you needed an AOL or a free sort of disk. You have to physically go into a store, get the disk loaded on your computer so that you could connect to the internet. And you went through a portal, right? You went through a portal like AOL or free serve in Europe, whereby your landing page was the portal. So you kind of come at it from a couple of different ways that you know, that you couldn't run applications over the internet back on a 56K, right? You could do email probably, but you certainly couldn't do anything heavier. So I don't know. I feel like it was probably around kind of 2001, 2002 that I was getting a hint that it was beginning to kind of kick off a little bit. I'd need to double check it, right?
Right. Yeah. No, that's about right. That's about right. You know, the young kids today, they're not going to fact check us. We can tell them anything. We can tell them anything we want. But you know, what's always What's always been the same is marketing sucks. That's why our marketing guy isn't on the show anymore.
Pete, I was warned about you, right? I mean, you're wearing your sales hat, right?
that's right, because the leads suck. Marketing sucks. You know, they throw them over the transom at us, and then we throw them back. How do you get sales and marketing to work together, or can they work together, Alan?
Well, firstly, we got to work on people's attitude, like yours, Pete, right? You got to be more more accommodating. You got to be more open, right? You can't be. This isn't a blame game. You got to remember, we have to be your friends because, again, there's no playbooks, but let's assume it's 50-50, right? Sales are originating 50% of leads through SDRs and account execs doing outbound. Maybe another 50% are generated by marketing, doing content, webinars, events, PR, et cetera. So you kind of got to be nice to us, right? Because you're right. There's this dance that goes on where sales like to blame marketing and marketing likes to blame product. Hey, product, you got to ship better features. If our product didn't suck, if our product, had, quadrant, top right quadrant in Gartner, we'd be very happy. If it was on G2 and Capterra and was getting, hundreds of five-star reviews, we'd be very happy. So we all have the ability to go and needle each other. And I think there's a couple of things to think about, right? So one is we really need a feedback channel, right? A feedback loop. The big Achilles heel, in my view, and when it comes to marketing, is we don't spend enough time listening into customer calls. We are chronically under-resourced as a function. There's 1,000 things to do at any one point in time. And the thing that we really should be doing a lot more of is listening in on sales calls. We don't. I don't know why, and part of it is probably bad prioritization. But in the absence of that, I think there needs to be a really strong feedback loop. And it can be a simple thing as having a dedicated Slack channel. And I've used this quite effectively with a couple of clients, actually, whereby, one example would be in a new category that we were in. I really pushed them to put, detailed, just quick snapshots in Slack. What was the keywords that they used to describe their pain? So when they came to articulating the problems they had, let's get the keywords in so we can start looking to make sure that our content is addressing that. Attribution is a big bugbear. We can help you if we really understand where the leads are coming from. Everyone assumes it's easy. Attribution is really hard, but the easiest way to get it is if you're on a sales call and you're talking to someone and you just throw in, look, Alan, curious, how did you hear about us? And I say, Google. Alan would love, get Google, it's the main browser. Can you remember what you searched for? Yeah, I searched for your brand. Huh, how did you know about our brand? Word of mouth referral. Put that in, so I guess we're looking for a more kind of collegiate, supportive atmosphere. And then the final thing is, I've got clients where I work with where our messaging is off. The pricing page may not have the features rank ordered in the hierarchy that the customers talk about. The features can be badly described. Marketing, because they're that one step away, can miss some of this stuff. So I think it's in sales' interest to be a lot more open and kind of proactive about feeding us back stuff that can help us do a better job.
Right. Well, not really, because there's very few salespeople that are. And let's just be honest, salespeople are kind of stupid at times. Okay, let's just be honest. And they're not. Yeah, they're not.
And they're liars. They're all liars.
Well, not all of them. Just you, Pete. No.
Two-thirds.
They're not going to go down that long process of like, hey, where did you find us? Google. They'll stop at Google. But you and I, Alan, you and I both know that the attribution is really hard, and it wasn't Google. It came from some other source mostly, because if you just trusted that they said Google, then you're going to miss out on that, that billboard that they saw driving by one time and things like that. But I feel at ZipRecruiter, we had a really good part. I had a very good partnership with our SVP of our CMO, actually. And the reason for that was because we were actually tied to a common metric. Now, we didn't share, when I say tied to, I mean, like we were measured by a common metric. Some people suggest, Alan, that marketing should have the same quota, share a quota, and that will force that kind of, you know, collaboration there. Two things. One, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on marketing, having and sharing the same exact quota as sales to truly get them on the same page. But second, you know, back to you, this was literally posted on LinkedIn just the other day. It was a survey and it read, what's the best way to give feedback to marketing if the quality of leads is poor? A, say nothing and hope it improves. B, email and Slack them. Or C, set a, you know, set a meeting. And first of all, I read that question. I was like, God, for God's sakes, like that's just so, you know, loaded. Like none of those answers are any good. So I'd love to get your feedback on both of those things. One, should marketing have a quota? And number two, if sales thinks the leads are bad, how do they give the, what's the best way for marketing to get that feedback?
Yeah. And look, the first one is very nuanced. And like the big challenge, and I'm going to again, give you guys a bit of context in the difference between US and Europe, right? So the big challenge we have in Europe is we're chronically under-resourced when it comes to the marketing functions, right? Mm-hmm. And you know what you see in the US is when you've got a Series A or a Series B, it could be a Series A of 20 million and a Series B of 100 million. The Series A in Europe could be 2 million and it could be Series B could be 10 million. So what you end up having is, you know, pretty small teams in Europe. So most marketing functions in B2B SaaS in Europe are two or three people. Obviously, as you scale and grow, you lever up. But then when you look at the kind of things that that team needs to do, you know, there is a thousand on it. It's not just lead acquisition. There can be some brand awareness can be done. There can be marketing or sales collateral. You mean, there's an endless list. I mean, and if you're kind of pre-product market fit, you got to go and really validate the assumptions that built the startup in the first place by talking to people. So there's an endless list of things where sales is a little bit more black and white, right? It's, you know, so it's much easier to kind of say, right, we're going to tie you to a number. And I've had this with people where they're really sticking the marketing function to kind of these lead figures. And I'm saying, fine, but just, you know, the team at present, you're asking us to do content. You're asking us to do events. You're asking us to do webinars. You're asking us to do collateral. You're asking us to build awareness. You're asking us to have a good employer brand. I'm looking around the table and I got two people on the team and they're both in their 20s and it's their first job out of college. So I think there's a bit of pushback, AG, in terms of, you know, I think there's a different argument if you're on a scale-up journey. So your ARR is pretty significant. You know, you're around for a number of years. You're on a different trajectory altogether. I think then you carve it out a little bit and you do try and align them because you're right. There's a quantity and quality argument. Kind of turning to your second question, of course, is the old Gilbert cartoon I think we had years ago about a dog filling in a form on the website, right? And sort of, you know, and that's kind of, you know, kind of relevant, right? Because marketing, when you look at one of our primary jobs in terms of the acquisition piece is getting people to fill in forms, whatever the call to action is, request demo. But we know human nature, you know, there's all kinds of people going to be filling in these forms, people looking for jobs, people looking to sell you something. Yeah. So I think there's always going to be an inherent tension around the quantity and the quality. And look, what I'd argue is you can't operate in silos. You've got to operate, collectively. And you've got to put in the diary a 30-minute or a 45-minute or one-hour call on a weekly basis to just shoot the breeze. Obviously, have a structured agenda. But, you know, it then becomes less about, you know, pointing fingers and saying the quality is poor. It's around, okay, why do we think it is? Getting back to the attribution. And like you can have silly things whereby you could have a new Google ad campaign that might, for whatever reason, target non-core regions because somebody left, didn't uncheck a button, and all of a sudden you're getting a load of leads coming from areas that aren't really relevant. You know, so there's always these nuances that that exist. So I don't know whether you share those views or whether you've got an alternative perspective that could obviously help inform the debate.
Hey, what do you think?
Where should, well, it gets down to where do the business development reps live? Is that marketing or sales?
I'd say they're in sales. So for me, there's SDRs, account execs, and BDR. They're all in the sales function, would be my take.
Okay. So it's not in marketing. They should be, they belong to sales, right? Do you see it? You consult with a lot of companies out there, and I'm sure it's more in the States than it is across the pond, but What percentage of companies do you think have the SDRs, BDRs, whatever the acronym is you want to use, reside in marketing versus sales, or everybody's in sales?
I'm seeing in Europe, again, I've never seen those. I mean, I've probably worked with 30 B2B SaaS companies in the last number of years. It's always been on the sales side of things, you know, business development reps. Sometimes it's outsourced. You know, the typical structure we'd see here would be, you'd have your junior SDRs doing outbound on your behalf. You'd have account execs make, you know, the SDRs may set up a discovery call with an account exec, and that account exec may hand it over the fence to BDR. Marketing typically in Europe would sit in a slightly different context, and they'd be responsible for a number of things. You know, going back to my 50-50 argument, they would be responsible for lead gen, but that would be typically through things like Google Ads, through things like events, through webinars, and of course, content, which is always so they would be kind of the main things. Then they'd probably be looking at things like activation. So when people hit the site, how do we get them activated, and potentially retention as well? But it strikes me from your side of the fence, are you arguing that it should sit in the marketing function, Pete?
I'm just asking because it comes down to budgets, right? You know, if the SDRs are part of marketing, then the leads can't suck because SDR is part of marketing, and it, you know, it's the handover, the transition when it gets over to sales is when you have the issues. Here, let me throw you a curveball, Alan. If you're in marketing, okay, and you don't have the SDRs, maybe this is the chief revenue officer's decision, but when do you, let's say an SDR costs 100,000 US all in, just throwing a number out there. When do you spend the money for that head, or when do you spend that money for the Google AdWords? When does marketing get to 100 grand? When does sales get to 100 grand?
That's a curveball. I don't think I even fully understand the question. If there's just 100K and you got to fight for it, how do you know where to allocate it? Is that what you're arguing?
Well, you can either have the SDRs pick up the phone and get the leads, or you can get the leads from marketing. When is it? What is a better use of the 100,000 or the, let's say it's a dollar, okay? What is a better use of funds, to go to Google or to get the rep? Yeah.
I'm tearing it in half and I'm giving a bit to each. I mean, I'd like to put my eggs in a few different baskets, right, and start measuring, you know, my ability to convert through those different channels. So I think, and this is my point, I think it's so nuanced that I think this is the kind of the tricky bit, that you can find things that work in some scenarios, just don't work in other scenarios. So, Pete, I'm probably dodging it by saying, I think you've got to try a few things, right? The tricky thing that we found with outbound and SDRs in Europe, and I don't know if you guys have the same issue in the States, is it takes quite a while to get it working, particularly in the early days. And you've got to have the patience to stay the year, because what happens 3 months in, everyone's shouting and roaring saying that there's no engagement. And
that's
of course,
right.
they blame the tool. So DiscoverOrg, or they blame, you know, Cognizant, which we big in Europe. They blame the tool. But it's so nuanced. You know, have you got your right personas defined? Have you got the right messaging? Are you willing to stay? Whereas Google Ads, the payoff is much quicker. You can throw a couple of landing pages up, put a couple of grand into Google Ads, fire some traffic at a landing page, and you know you may see some conversions. Again, it depends on the category, right? If it's a transactional type play,
yeah,
you'll get conversions pretty soon. If it's enterprise, you won't. So Pete, I'm kind of pushing the curveball back to you, saying
it depends.
I think you got to, yeah, right, and like. That's a frustrating answer in some ways, but I think it's a case of you just got to test a few different ones and see then if you can get a decent measure on the. But ultimately, I think what you'll end up doing is you'll probably end up, you know, like a bar stool, you'll have three legs, right? So you'll probably be running content, you'll probably be running paid acquisition, and you'll be probably running SDR. And, you know, going back to the attribution, they may help each other, right? Yeah. You might be doing ads on LinkedIn that get spotted by the same people that are getting inbounds, right? So.
Yeah, no, there's definitely data out there, Alan, that suggests that there is a smaller portion of BDR and SDR teams that report up into marketing. In fact, my last company before I retired was Upkeep just last year. And when I started, they had SDR BDRs reporting into marketing. And the very first thing I did was commandeer that because I wanted to make sure to be able to have that level of control. So it wasn't this like, hey, we're, you know, they're throwing leads over and they're not working. You know, I wanted to have that, you know, that accountability. There's no doubt about it. But I think for our listeners, Alan, you said it, and I want to emphasize it. you know, Pete, there is no black and white answer. It's you have to test it. And the other thing you also said, Alan, which is so right on, for God freaking sakes, have some patience with these BDR, SDR teams. You know, it's not like Google AdWords where you whip up a landing page and a lead comes in and boom, there it is. And see, it's working. You know, it takes time. You're dealing with humans that have to get up and running, and you're dealing with the like you said, the messaging. And of course, the percentage of connect rates that these BDR, SDRs are getting are infinitesimal these days. It still works. It just works at a smaller percentage, and you have to be willing to test into that investment, as opposed to saying we tried SDRs for 2-3 months and they didn't work, so BDRs, SDRs don't work. That's an immature way of looking at it.
That's exactly it. Because the other kind of nuance you got to factor in, right, is that there's a couple of weird things. Like the fact that the B2B SaaS is increasingly going on these narrow verticals is it's hard to get statistical significance because you're just not getting the volumes through. So that's the first thing. And secondly, with outbound, it's kind of law of large numbers, right? We know that a cold email may get a 20% open rate and a kind of a click-through might be in the single digits, right? So if you're only sending 100 emails, do the math. You know, it ain't going to fly, right? So there's a couple of ways you do. You either spend a lot more so that you're sending a lot more emails out, or you're kind of being patient to go on the journey. And I guess I go back to the problem we're finding, you know, in Europe, and I guess the States probably to a lesser extent, is that, you know, particularly VC-backed firms, they're watching cash flow and they're impatient for quick return, and they can't be content with the kind of come back in 6 months and then we can decide. So, you know, I wouldn't like to be in an outbound SDR agency at the moment. I mean, if I was, I'd be only doing 1 year contracts, because otherwise you do a 3 month contract and your client's going to churn, right? They're going to be expecting results. Whereas if you do it for a year, you're committing to the journey. You're signaling up front, this is the time it will take. And to your point, KG, it'll work, but it'll be, you know, and this is the kind of last point, and then we go to another question is, you know, outbound isn't going to work if the annual recurring revenue is 2K, right? You know, it's going to be, the unit economics aren't going to work on the smaller contract values. You really got to be picking it on the kind of elephant hunting bigger enterprise where you're getting a decent check, because otherwise the maths just don't work, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I think it was Serious Decisions, Alan, that published, it was Serious Decisions and another firm that suggested that if your ACV, your annual contract value, is less than like 20K, SDR, the math just doesn't work when you insert the human. And this was 5-6 years ago. Now the cost of SDRs are even higher. So when you insert that, unless your product has an amazing LTV and, you know, super sticky, an ACV of less than 20 grand, it doesn't make any sense to have an SDR generating leads. In fact, that's what we did, Alan, at ZipRecruiter. Our annual contract value was about $5,000-$6,000 several years ago. It's higher now, I believe. But we tested and tried like 5 different iterations of SDRs, BDRs, because we had hypothesis. And again, we were testing everything. We thought that perhaps even though our ACV was low, we can improve conversion rates and in velocity. So the volume of transactions would go up significantly to make up for having the SDR, BDR in there. That failed. We tried the other initiative, which was only focus on the big deals, qualify these SDRs so that they're above $20,000. And we couldn't get enough deals above 20 grand to justify having the SDRs in there. And we had like 3 other iterations of BDR SDRs. And we just, with that deal size, we just couldn't make it work. We made it work on the enterprise side, by the way. Those are the bigger deals. We were doing $50,000 a year, at least at that time. But yeah, you're right. It's BDRs, SDRs, it's hard. And you've got to be committed. You've got to be committed over time and be willing to test and experiment, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a great post. It's a few years old by a guy called Joel York, a US commentator, and he talks about the startup graveyard, and he sort of has a matrix, and he kind of literally, you do the maths and you can see. And the challenge again is, of course, is, you know, you need to know your unit economics for SaaS, right? You need to be pretty hot in numbers. You need to be having mature conversations with your CFO or finance people. And traditionally in Europe, finance people, you know, they did profit and losses, they did accounts, right? You know, SaaS accounting is a very different kettle of fish, right? It's sort of, you know, there's some very weird dynamics about it in terms of pressure and cash flows. You grow, you know, the need for sales and marketing up front, those costs up front, and obviously the revenue is coming into the future. You know, the implications of how your business model breaks if people churn after a year or 2 years. So, you know, it's very, going back to a question you asked right at the start, why am I kind of interested in it? Because I think it's intellectually a very rewarding space, because it's endlessly kind of challenging, right? And if you're up for it, you know, you kind of get a lot of intellectual stimulation from the job, which I think you don't get in other areas.
Yeah.
Alan, a key word that I've heard from you is feedback. And you have the States and then you have across the pond, the UK. It's a lot harder to remove somebody from their position in the UK than the States, I would imagine. And in order to remove somebody, they need to have feedback that they're not performing the job that they should be, or not coaching them and how they could get better. How often should you have coaching sessions? I mean, is it weekly one-on-ones? Is it quarter reviews, annual reviews? What's your thoughts on that, Alan?
Yeah, so the trend over here, again, in Europe, annual appraisals are kind of dead. So the view that, you know, an annual appraisal was used, particularly kind of grew out of banking, to, you know, allocate bonuses at the end of the year, that's kind of dead in the water, right? So there's no doubt that there's been a move away from that. One of my clients actually is a company called Appraised, which is a bit like Lattice. So that would be very much in the space, which kind of has software for helping with performance management. Their kind of mantra is more frequent is really, really important. I guess what they've noticed, though, and again, this will be part of the philosophy I would share, is a couple of things. One, a lot more of us are working remotely in Europe at the moment. So there's definitely a disconnect in terms of regular, almost like water cooler chat, where you could probably have a bit of a feedback loop or a bit of a chin wag. That's kind of gone with everybody working remotely. But also there's this just the sense that continuous, you know, feedback and kind of having a philosophy of, you're not criticizing somebody, but that you're very much you're looking at what we determine marginal gains or continuous improvement. So, you know, my approach is, and it works a bit easier with more junior people, is, look, I've got a lot of experience here. There's a learning journey here we're going on. You know, let's go on it together. So, you know, part of it is regular coaching, I think, particularly when you start going back to some of the earlier themes that I would have talked about, which is that, you know, it is a complex space. It's very nuanced. And you look at sales, for example, you know, which you guys are more familiar with, you know, there are no sales courses in Europe, right, per se. Like, I would have done a primary degree in marketing. It's probably not fit for purpose because it's a different sort of type of marketing. But, you know, so sales is one of these careers you grow into. So I'm a very strong believer in, you know, trying to have regular coaching, regular feedback, regular mentorship, but done so in a way that, you know, cards on the table. It's two ways, right? This is just about collectively trying to solve problems, not being a kind of a hierarchical boss. You did this wrong, you did that wrong, you did this wrong. Very much though, here, let's share ideas to try and get you to a better position.
So would you say it depends. Is that what you're saying?
To give the feedback? Yeah, again, and that's going to be a phrase you write down afterwards. And is Alan dodging the questions by saying it depends? I mean, you know, I think, like, we're all very busy, right? Nobody's got time to be sitting down for an hour of feedback 360 every week, right? So I think what I'm kind of saying is communication is key, particularly with remote working. So I'm more on a, okay, you want to time me to it? You know, maybe a formal weekly chat, you know, for 15 minutes.
How about this? Whatever the time period is, have a write it down and give written feedback back to the person. How's that?
There you go. Okay. Ping an email straight afterwards or a Slack. Totally. Obviously, okay. You don't want a huge gap between what you observe and feedback. That's why annual appraisals were terrible, right? Oh, yeah, last March you did this. Yeah. Nobody can remember, totally. Right?
So what are some, so when you're coaching some of your marketing proteges, let's say, either they report to you or they're clients of yours, what do you feel are some of the tips that you give to your proteges or clients on mastering B2B sales, B2B SaaS marketing?
Yeah, look, I'm a great believer in bias for action, you know, so I'm less worried about academic credentials.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not so pressed in that. It's like a bias for action. So, you know, when I do interview processes, I look for digital footprint. And you know, by that, I mean, if I Google their name, even if they're a junior, have they got a Medium account? You know, have they written an article? Have they written a blog? Have they put up a Wix or a Squarespace site? You know, so I think there's a couple of things. So one is a bias for action. So I'm really about getting stuff done. You know, it's not a 20-page report anymore. Give me a 1-page summary. Yeah. You know, it's a very demanding role. There's an awful lot constantly coming at you. So you got to be able to be comfortable with that world, right? So you got to be able to have a method for putting all these tasks into where you can prioritize. So bias for action for one. You know, you got to go on a continuous learning journey, right? I guess you guys, you're probably the same as me. It's not like you can kind of close the book when you're done after your academic stuff. Mm. You kind of have to have your couple of go-to blogs that you're reading on a regular basis. So you've got to have this voracious appetite for ongoing learning. If you don't, I don't think it's the right kind of function for you, because I think it is demanding. So there are some of the things, less about academic credentials, more about an appetite for learning, appetite for doing demonstrable evidence that you can, you know, show that's, like, sales is the same, right? I had interviews previously with people and I couldn't find them on LinkedIn, and they're looking to get a senior sales role. I'm like, I'm sorry, you can give me whatever reason you want, but you don't have a LinkedIn profile. You know, I don't buy it, right? I mean, I don't buy it. Like, that's where you got to live, right? And if you're in B2B sales, right? So there's some of the things.
Alan, being in marketing, and we're on a podcast right now, how do you see companies starting to use podcasts as a cross between marketing and sales, or softening up the market to get leads? Do you think a lot of companies are there yet, or everybody's just figuring it out?
Yeah, I think you got to... A couple of things on that, Pete. So, and I won't say it depends, right? So this time I'm not going to say it depends.
Finally.
I think it goes back to the broader understanding of the kind of purpose of marketing, and it kind of can't be solely through the lens of the hard-nosed lead gen, right? Because, you know, things like brand awareness, you know, is important, right? And not everything is kind of cause and effect, whereby, like, Google Ads probably is, right? But, you know, as you mature as a company, you know, your CEO is going to have to be public, right? Their focus shifts from being internally focused to externally focused. So podcasts are just part of the general element that helps to get people to understand the person a little bit more, gets to demonstrate expertise, for example. It gets people to be educated, right? Because the philosophy of most of my work is, you know, it's more on solving people's problems and helping them solve problems. So if you're kind of aligned on that philosophy, the leads will come, right? So I think if your mantra is, you know, I'm not on this pitching, I'm not promoting anything, I'm more just having a conversation to share stories that I think could help other people. And I think there are some of the elements that I think podcasting can be very useful, whereby you go from an anonymous profile on a website to understanding a bit more about a person and a bit more about their thoughts and a bit more about their attitude and their experience. So there are some of the softer things, but it goes back to marketing's remit is a lot broader than just the kind of lead gen piece. So that's how I'd address that one.
All right. Well, let's transfer over to blogs then. I'm sure you've written a lot. Besides your own blogs, do you have any go-to marketing blogs that you could suggest to our listeners out there?
Yeah, I do. I mean, what's funny, right, is a lot of blogs, they're male, right? They're often US. So what's interesting is we could all benefit from more diversity in the blogs, right? So,
yeah,
you know, I like people like Mark Suster. I think he's an interesting writer. He's a VC in California. KG, I don't know if you've come across him. He's not as prolific writing as he used to be. But some of his old stuff is timeless. David Scott is another guy that would fall into that kind of bucket. He's in Matrix in Boston, another VC. Mm-hmm. Andrew Chen has just written a book worth looking up on, Cold Start. Tom Tungus, another VC. So some of the more interesting people in the space are actually the VCs that are writing about their kind of experiences, with Mark Suster probably being the standout there. Yeah. And then there's a guy, Avanish, who I particularly like, Avanish Kaushik, who's got a blog called Occam's Razor. I'm going to have to email you later to spell that because it's a bit tricky. But it's fantastic. He's based in California, probably not too far from UKG. And Avanish has a weekly blog and newsletter, actually. It's one of my only paid newsletters that I actually subscribe to. And it's very much more on the kind of data side of things. So he's not marketing per se, but it's data and analytics, but he's endlessly fascinating. So that's a snapshot of some of those that I enjoy.
And you brought up VCs, Alan. In marketing, at the different series of funding, could you, because we have a lot of new managers, a lot of new reps that listen, marketing executives, could you just quickly go through the different rounds of funding and then how you would deal with marketing at each level?
Well, Pete, we could be here for the long day, right?
It depends. It depends.
Yeah. And look, it changes, right? So seed and series A. So normally what you have is you might raise what's called a seed round, which might be the first checks in, you know, angel rounds. There's a guy called Jaisal Kakanis in California.
Yeah.
Who you guys may be familiar with, who's probably the most prolific blogger and podcast host in the sweet spot. So a lot of his stuff is, so they might be the first couple of checks in, right? And at that stage, you're looking for kind of, you just got some assumptions that you want validated. So you're really trying to focus. And this is kind of a key piece, Pete. At that stage, it's not about lead gen, right? It's about validating the assumptions. So again, you know, there's a methodology espoused by a guy called Eric Ries and Steve Blank. Again, they're both in California. And they talk about the lean startup methodology, which is kind of in that space, right? Which is essentially saying the first check is not about lead gen. It's about go and have as many conversations as you possibly can about the problem that you perceive exists and how your solution resolves that problem. So focus on that. If you then find that you're getting, you know, piquing people's interest, and there's people that are saying, yeah, I can totally relate to the problem, and I would pay for a solution to solve it, and you're directionally solving it for them, then you might go look for a Series A check. I had my rant earlier because the problem is a lot of Series A checks in Europe, you know, they're not large enough. So some of my earlier companies that I worked with, we got checks for $1 million. Mm. And you're doing an enterprise sale that could be a sales cycle of a year.
Yeah.
And you're first to market with it. Your cash is gone in 3 months and you're back to the well. And but at that stage, you're kind of, you know, in the US, you're getting bigger checks than Europe, right? So you might be getting a 5 or 10 million. That's definitely very much around, you know, validating that the product market fit is there, you know, trying to do a land grab initially. Obviously, if you've got a much bigger check, you can do a winner takes all approach whereby you're kind of creating the category, you're looking for, you know, product leadership. And then as you sort of scale up Series B, Series B and C, the checks are much larger. You're kind of in acquisition territory where you're maybe picking up a couple of smaller players. You might be doing first boots on the ground in Europe with physical presence in Asia as well. Your marketing function then all of a sudden becomes international. There are some of the elements, Pete. I could go on and on, but for the sake of brevity, I'll pause there. But that's something to think about.
So what's the right time for a company to expand out into Europe, Alan? Depends. What are some of the mistakes?
You're just gonna keep hammering this poor guy.
Am I the first guest that's ever given that as an answer? I hope I'm not right. I hope others are kind of.
He's just.
I'm being a sasshole. I'm a sasshole.
Jesus, leave the poor guy alone. My God.
Would I be the first guest if I got up and walked out? Would that help with the virality?
Yes.
Well, I think the listenership would pick up.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
There we go. No, I'm not going to plead the fifth. I'm going to answer it, right? So look, SaaS, you know, from day one, right, your website should be able to take people from all over the world, right? That should be part of the journey, right? What I would say then is the big markets historically are always the US, right? You guys have a phenomenal opportunity because, you know, throw Canada into the mix. And you got a very big domestic market that's pretty much the same. You come across to Europe, the UK is the biggest next market that will typically show up. But the UK has been a bit funny the last couple of years because they've taken their ball and they've left the play group and said, we don't want to play with you guys anymore. And we're going over here. So yeah. They've left the European Union. This isn't a political podcast, but it does create extra kind of, Europe is a lot more fragmented, right? We've got lots of different languages and currencies and sort of, but we still have this European Union entity, which is a pretty big block. So what I'd suggest you do, Pete, is from day one, you should be running something like Google Analytics and Google Search Console. So you'll start getting early indications of where the traffic pools are from non-US traffic, right? But you got to always treat Google Analytics with a hint of caution, right? Because you can fall into traps going, wow, look at India. India is the second biggest source of traffic to our site. Yeah, but when you look at a kind of purchase power parity or kind of the purchasing power of that market, a lot of that, you know, cohort are not looking for B2B SaaS solutions. Their motivations for visiting your site are very different. Yeah. So I guess I'm a great believer in pattern recognition. So, you know, look at your early analytics, look at your early search console, but then look at closed won. Yeah. You know, look at the deals that are closed won. That's the first, because obviously if you're able to close remotely, and you can close remotely because a lot of European consumers are comfortable buying off American companies. They don't need to see you guys face to face, even for higher ticket items that previously you would have needed to fly here to meet. You can now increasingly serve those remotely. So there's some of the elements. So I guess straight out the gate, you want to be doing this, but don't fall into the trap then, I guess, of trying to internationalize everything, going, hey, let's do a Spanish version, let's do a French version. There's a huge hidden cost to doing that sort of localization. And what you'll actually find is that most enterprise buyers in Europe are going to have English as a native. If not a native tongue, they'll have it as a second language. So don't fall into the trap of trying to customize and localize everything.
So if you want to dip your toe in the water, you could outsource. Ireland is pretty popular. A lot of call centers out there. Any particular reason why legally?
Ireland is huge, right, for it. So in terms of foreign direct investment, Ireland punches way above its weight. There's a bit of a bias because you've picked up the accent. I'm from Ireland originally. There's a couple of reasons, right? You know, Americans rocking up in Ireland. The first wave had literally family connections, right? That was often one of the drivers. It was like, yeah, I'm familiar with Ireland. My grandparents were from there or whatever. And obviously very highly populated, very highly populated education system, right? So sorry, very well-educated population, right? So the number at third level is really very high. It's in the European Union, which is a big tick, which goes against the UK just after moving out. And then, of course, what we have is we've the likes of Apple, EMC, Dell, Google, Facebook. They've been in there a long, long time, and they've really got significant operations there. So you get this flywheel effect where people are getting, you know, they're getting to learn a little bit about, you know, working in these big organizations. And then they're able to, when a smaller company comes out and looks at where they grow in Europe, Ireland becomes an obvious landing point. And then you can walk around parts of Dublin and, it looks and feels a bit like certain parts of the US, right? We probably don't have, the high streets aren't quite the same, but you'll get your Starbucks latte, right? You'll get your, it doesn't feel as alien, which quirks, right? There's some of the reasons. There's a good tax system there. I could go on, but definitely, right. There's an event called SaaStock. SaaStock runs every November. And that is in Ireland. And that's the perfect point. If you're ever looking to consider Europe, you should go to SaaStock. Hopefully we'll be in person this year. It's obviously the last few years it's been remote, but that's a big conference where you get a lot of Americans flying in. And that gives them an opportunity to see the lay of the land in places like Dublin and put an office down.
Yeah. I love what you were saying, by the way, wrapping back to the when and how can you, you know, expand into Europe there. I hear you because I faced the exact same thing at Upkeep, my last company. We looked at the data and we found that we got tons of leads that were coming in from India and South Africa. And South Africa was actually easy to facilitate because the language barrier was not there. India was difficult. But yeah, my operations guy was wise enough to give me the data that I was asking for. We found that the conversion rates in India and conversion rates in South Africa, while visits and leads were very large outside of the US, the conversion rates were low. And when we dug even deeper into that by listening to some calls and talking to salespeople, they said, yeah, they give us this price objection all the time. Boy, it's too expensive. Now look, dyed in the wool sales guy, too expensive. Let's overcome up that price objection.
Right.
No. You called it, purchase power parity, I think is what you just, right, what you said.
Right.
Yeah. We were one of the lowest cost softwares for maintenance management in the industry, highly rated on G2 and low cost. And India is saying, and South Africa is saying, too expensive.
Okay. Right.
So, you know, we weren't going to dedicate resources there, but we did have a resource in the UK, and she was local, and she, right, was local. There truly, I learned when I built an SDR team in the UK at one of my previous companies, by the way, there's, you know, yeah, the language is the same, but it's not used exactly the same. And right, the cultures are different too. And so it's not plug and play. There are some nuances to selling to people in the UK versus selling to people in the US. What do you think about that?
Listen, I totally agree, right? So I think, and of course, the beauty of it is that there's a lot of freelancers like myself. So freelancing didn't exist 10 years ago to the same extent, whereas there's an awful lot of freelance consultants that can facilitate market entry, right, and into different places. And you're absolutely right. I mean, I do recall a couple of years ago, probably 10 years ago, actually, in the first tranche of a big American companies I used to see rocking up in London. And I remember I spoke to a couple, actually, of the biggest names that you guys would have in the kind of software space. And, you know, I remember one putting in an entire team, flying over three or four as the boots in the ground initially. And you know, it struck me as being so wrong. These guys and girls were, you know, they were pretty young, pretty junior, pretty green. They were bright, right? But I don't know if they'd been into Europe before, and sort of, I just couldn't for the life of me understand why that step was being missed, right, about just using local expertise. And look, I'll give you a funny one. So, you know, I've got a couple of clients in the US that are looking at market entry into Europe, and you know, I've friends and former colleagues, and they'll pick up a phone and they'll have a chat with me, and I'll kind of signpost them in different directions because they know that this local presence or having some connection with someone locally is worth its weight in gold, and just not trying to fly in, you know, without using some local connections.
Yeah, no question about it. I'm going to make a joke. This is a real story, Alan. When I was building this SDR team, I didn't know that pants meant something different in the UK. And to those that are from, you know, not from the UK, pants means underwear in the UK. And it was, and I'm making that joke, Alan, because this was the naivete that I brought to the table when I'm building this SDR team in the UK. And there's, you know, the language is the same, but there's some differences there. And so having somebody local on the ground to help you and guide you in localizing that go-to-market effort is important.
You can get unstuck on things that you're not even thinking about. So you could be thinking pricing, but, you know, some people buy decisions on where does the data reside. Right, they don't want data, you know, flying from Europe across to America and coming back because of, you know, security concerns, and because of, you know, there's different. I'm probably out of my depth in terms of knowing exactly the kind of specifics, but you have this scenario now where the UK is outside of Europe, and I know of people, you know, that have got issues that used to be able to work in Ireland remotely and can no longer work in Ireland remotely because the data is now being transferred, outside of the European Union. So like even small things like this, and of course SaaS is all about data moving around the world, right? So those sort of nuances can be completely lost, and they're not language. They're related to kind of just some of the weirdness about the market, right? That that mean that you could be on calls and you could be losing them on grounds that you've got no idea as to what's driving the decision. Yeah. Sorry, Pete, you were going to come in on something, I think.
No, I was going to say, Kevin, it's a good thing you don't smoke because you have to be careful about asking for a cigarette.
Hey, this is a family show, Pete. No, I'm kidding.
It's assholes. Oh, Alan, we know you're not taking on any more clients, but if somebody wants to learn more about you, let's just say you have a client drop off in the event that could ever happen.
Sure.
What's the best way for somebody to get a hold of you?
I think alangleason.com, you'll find me there, or Work With Agility. Work With Agility is my company website. I'm not as prolific on Twitter as I used to be. And Medium, I used to be writing quite a lot, but that's dropped off a little bit. But yeah, you can hit me up on Work With Agility. You'll find me on LinkedIn as well. So feel free to send a message through and I'll help in whatever way I can.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for coming on the show today. What a great time. You're a good sport.
Pete, thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed chatting to you guys. And thanks, KG, as well.
You got it.
Hey, we'll put all the links in the podcast notes. And Alan, I run about 80% correct, so you may want to check me afterwards. Thanks for listening.
I'm pretty happy. I'm pretty happy. You go with it.
Hey, thanks for listening to Sassholes. On behalf of KG and myself, Pete, we thank you for listening. And we ask that you give us 5 stars in Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to our weekly news letter. You'll find it in the podcast notes. And hey, if you really, really like us, you can always buy us a beer on Patreon/Sassholes. We thank you for listening. Cue the music.